How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, for over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. Joining me to talk about inborn errors of immunity is a patient advocate and a fellow genetic counselor. Rare disease advocate Felicia Morton is the founder and executive director of the CGD Association of America. Felicia has been a well-known advocate for the community for more than a decade, armed with her family's personal experience. Tori Howell is a clinical genomic liaison. At Blueprint Genetics, she received her Master's of Science in Genetic Counseling from the University of Texas and MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. Felicia and Tori, thanks so much for coming on for this really important conversation that we really haven't covered too much on the show, which is surprising after 250 episodes. So thank you so much both for taking the time to come on and educate the audience.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So I thought we could kick off the conversation by defining inborn errors of immunity. And Tori, I thought it would be nice to hear from you of just how this group of conditions is, you know, typically discussed and kind of maybe what people might know of it previously being called. Because I remember when I was planning this episode with you guys, I was like, I have not heard of this term. And then I was like, oh, it's because it's a newer term. So tell us a little bit about just defining IEIs.
Yeah, oh, that's a great question. Yeah, previously, inborn errors of immunity was referred to as primary immunodeficiency. So a lot of people might know it as that term. But as the name implies, we're dealing with the immune system. So when we think about the immune system, we think about the body's main defense system. And really, it includes two functions. The first function is to recognize and differentiate our own body from foreign invaders and pathogens, or even abnormal versions of ourselves like tumors. And then the second function is to actually defend us, right? To prevent those threats or infections from causing us harm. So then if we pair the immunity with the inborn errors part, what that's really referring to is the genetic component. And it's referring to when there is a genetic variation that causes some dysregulation of the immune system that prevents it from performing its normal function. So either it can't recognize a threat or it can't properly defend us against that threat. And that's when these conditions come about.
And it's really, as you were saying, an umbrella term. There's a lot of conditions that fall under this category and this type of disease. What types of conditions, like what are some of the more common ones that if people have maybe heard of some of these, especially if they're fellow genetic counselors listening or people working in genetics, are there ones that they might be more familiar with? I mean, do we have like a number of like, oh, we have about this many that we've identified as being under this umbrella?
Sure. No, that's a great question. And again, because the immune system is so complex and there are so many different cells and thousands of proteins that involve, there are a variety of conditions that can range from susceptibility to infectious diseases. So something that many are aware of are like severe combined immunodeficiency. That's one that a lot of people have heard of. We even have newborn screening for it. But then there are also more rare conditions that maybe people haven't heard of. Chronic granulomatous disease is going to be one that obviously Felicia is going to give us more information about. But there are a variety of conditions. There's your auto-inflammatory conditions like familial Mediterranean fever. Some have heard of that. That's under the umbrella of IEIs or inborn errors of immunity. So there's really a lot of variation. And in fact, there are so many conditions that there is the International Society, the IUIS, or the International Union of Immunological Societies, that every couple of years publishes a list of all of these different conditions. And the last one was published in 2022. And there were 485 different genes that have been associated with various conditions. So there really are a lot of them. And they organize them into 10 different components or 10 different groups, depending on which part of the immune system they encompass. Right. So that, again, that could be anything from your innate immunity to your complement system, even your bone marrow failures, because we know our white blood cells, which are the cells of the immune system, are made in your bone marrow. And so you can have a bone marrow failure system, and that results in an inborn error of immunity. So those are kind of just a flavor of them, but there are numerous conditions for sure.
And when should someone, either themselves as just being a patient advocate, or on the flip side, providers, suspect that we could have one of these conditions here? I mean, for, as someone that is not an expert in this area of genetics, I'm thinking like, oh, if someone is constantly sick and constantly having infections and things like that, but that's kind of hard, especially when kids are young and they're going to daycare and different things and they're always sick. So exactly. I don't know, like what are some things that people should be aware of like, I don't know if red flags is the right phrase for it, but things to be mindful of like, I should start being suspicious for an IEI.
Sure. Yeah. And it's certainly very hard with little kids. And the thing to note is actually, while many of these conditions do present in childhood for sure, these conditions can present throughout the lifetime. And some of these conditions are really actually just mainly diagnosed in adults because that's when they present. But when we think about, you know, what are kind of some signs or symptoms that the clinicians should be suspicious of, certainly, yes, frequent infections above the norm. That can be very hard to figure out with little kids, especially with the fall coming around. But definitely more frequent infections and very atypical infections. So bacterial and fungal infections that you don't normally see in kiddos that your doctor, you know, would pick up on and say, you know, or even bacteria that normally is just present within us and doesn't cause a problem, but all of a sudden in this child, you're seeing that it actually is causing an infection. And so with that, in addition to more frequent infections, you have more severe infections. And these can often require multiple rounds of antibiotics to clear up when that's not typical, or even higher doses of antibiotics. So needing to be admitted and be put on IV antibiotics when that's not the norm should kind of raise suspicion that, hey, maybe we're dealing with something where the immune system is not able to take care of this on its own. And then the last one that we'll sometimes see paired with this whole picture is failure of a kiddo to grow along the typical path. So failure to gain weight or, you know, height on the what we would expect can also be seen. And then finally, for your like auto-inflammatory conditions, seeing an inflammation response when there isn't a clear reason for that, or, you know, more frequently than you would expect, kind of like recurrent fevers or just inflammation in areas that you wouldn't normally see.
And some of that is like more specific, like you were saying, like, you know, a bacteria or something that is just normally in humans, but then it's causing a reaction like that's abnormal. But then, you know, something like failure to thrive, that's tough because it's so generic. So it's such a combination between that. Felicia, I'd love to loop you in and just learning a little bit more about how you got involved with the community and just, you know, how the diagnostic odyssey was like for your family and who in your family is impacted.
I got involved with the CGD community when my son was diagnosed in 2012. He was diagnosed at 5 months old, and we did have a diagnostic odyssey. Around 6 weeks of age, he started to develop fevers, very high. That's another hallmark of an immune deficiency, a fever of an unknown origin. It lasted for about 10 days. It went as high as 105.
And that's very severe.
The doctors were scratching their heads. They could not understand why. There was no reason that they could find that he was having these symptoms. And so they sent us to have tests for cancer, tests for leukemia. Those all came back negative. And then mysteriously, the fevers vanished. He did have a dose of antibiotics, and he was fine. And we went on and said, okay, well, that was mysterious, and The doctor said, well, that's good. It's over. You know, these things happen. Then a few weeks later, he started to develop skin abscesses. And that's another sign of immune deficiency. And after several of these kinds of episodes, when we were going back and forth to doctors and specialists and emergency rooms, I was the one who had asked our pediatrician if he felt that there might be something happening from an immune disorder perspective, from an immune deficiency perspective. Unlike a lot of other parents out there, I happen to have a background in healthcare and public relations. I had worked on several projects involving various clients in the pharmaceutical industry that had several treatments for immune deficiencies. And so the irony is that I was able to somewhat diagnose my own son. My pediatrician said, well, I guess you could see an immunologist, as if, you know, why not?
Like, and, you could go to a trip to Hawaii, like if you want to. Like, that's a weird way to phrase that. Yeah.
Right. And so we did that. And that is how Sebastian was diagnosed, when we went to see an immunologist who gave him a DHR test, a blood test. And so at that point, my world fell apart. I had a public relations firm in Manhattan at that time, and I had to do a complete 180. I immediately pivoted from doing more work. At that point, I was in more of a different field, working more in high-tech PR. And I went back to my roots and started going out to different patient advocacy groups, telling them who I am, what my diagnosis what the diagnosis of my son was, and just asking them for information. And I got connected to quite a few different organizations. I saw that there was a need for someone to be advocating for chronic granulomatous disease, which is called CGD, as you know. And I stepped in and I began working with various organizations in that capacity. And when it became clear that we needed to start our own independent organization, I did that in 2020 with the help of the National Institutes of Health. And I've been very grateful for industry support as well. And we've been able to launch the CGD Association of America, which has a mission of supporting patients with CGD, as well as X-linked carriers, by providing unbiased news and information. I also have a background as a journalist, so I write a lot about the disease and news and treatments that are new or advances in research that would be of interest to our community. We also support research ourselves, and we've worked on several IRB-approved studies that are advancing the knowledge of CGD in the past few years.
Wow, that's fantastic, just how you were, you know, went on this diagnostic odyssey with your son, and at such a young age, too, that must have just been incredibly scary, to be having a fever so high and then kind of just trying to figure out what was going on. At what point did you learn, like, the background genetic part of it, in terms of, like, you being a carrier and that whole aspect to it? Because I imagine things happened in pieces. It probably wasn't all one day.
No, it wasn't. One of the things I'm very grateful for is that the National Institutes of Health has a lot of interest in CGD. When I learned about this condition, I'd been told by several advocacy groups to reach out to the immunology division at the NIH. And I would recommend anyone who has an immune deficiency to do that, because the NIH does, if you qualify, offer free services, you will be recruited as part of a study, or your son or your child in this case. And so we traveled there to Maryland, and he was put into a study, and we really learned a lot about his condition there. with the top experts in the world for CGD. And at that time, they also tested me, and we found out that I was a carrier. Thankfully, there are different levels of severity, and I don't have a severe manifestation of what could be serious when it comes to being a CGD carrier. There are different levels, so I'm okay. This also led me to test my mom, who had had frequent infections and mysterious symptoms over the years, and it turned out that she was a carrier too. But unlike myself, she was what's called highly lionized, which means that there's a good X and a bad X that females have, and her body, for whatever reason, was using more of the bad X with the genetic mutation, and so she was more symptomatic. And we're really grateful for her getting tested, because since then she's been able to take what's called CGD prophylaxis, which is a preventative regimen of medicine, and she does that daily, and she has not experienced any further symptoms, and she has a quality of life that she's never really had for many years. So we're very grateful, and a lot of carriers are expressing that. So we are looking to raise awareness amongst carriers. We're finding now in the medical field, not just CGD, but many female X-linked carriers who were just thought to be carriers who would pass on a genetic mutation to their child. They were thought to be asymptomatic. And in some cases, like in mine, we are, but in some cases we aren't. And this has been an overlooked population, an underserved, undertreated population. And we're really advocating for these moms, sisters, grandmothers, who also need to take their symptoms seriously. And there are treatments available for them where they can have a quality of life that they also deserve.
Yeah, that is something that I think is not talked about enough, that, you know, there's a lot of exceptions in genetics, and that's one of them. When we say, oh, well, carriers, you know, like, you don't have symptoms, it's just if you have a child that matches in terms of autosomal recessive conditions, X-linked is a little different, but that's not always the case. And I've really stopped using that terminology, because there's so many exceptions to that, where it's like, it gets to a point where you're like, okay, it doesn't even make sense to say that anymore. We say, in most cases, people tend not to have symptoms, but, you know, I think that's changing with just how much we're doing, especially with people doing carrier screening, which I imagine with how rare this is, maybe it's not on a lot of carrier screening that people are just doing on a routine basis. But I wanted to circle back to one thing you said about how your son was diagnosed, because from what I'm learning, there's two main ways, and correct me, Tori and Felicia, if I'm wrong, of diagnosing. One seems to be the one you mentioned, and then there's a genetic test. Do you know the difference between that? Like, how does that work?
I think that there's a lot for our patient community to learn here. Most of us are, or our children are diagnosed via what's called a DHR test. There's also a nitrous blue oxide test, which is not as common. From my understanding, if once that diagnosis is made, then other members of the family might also be interested in genetic testing. And so for example, carriers, if there's a suspicion that there might be other children as well who could have the disease as opposed to being a carrier, that might be also when genetic testing could come into place, especially when you're thinking about having children. That's another time. So there are these different points in the lives of our community when they might choose one type of testing versus the other, but there's still so much more that our community needs to learn and really how to advocate for themselves about what kind of test they might want, and to be able to learn about their condition in more detail, because really knowledge is power. And once they know what it is, they can determine, you know, the path forward.
A lot of labs don't offer the genetic testing version of this, but Blueprint is one of the few labs that does. And that's kind of how we ended up connecting because you connected with Blueprint at a conference and then, you know, they sponsor, you know, this episode of the show and everything. Tori, anything to add in terms of just Blueprint? And I don't know if you know of anything of just like the decision to include this or on panels and just kind of a little more insight of what Blueprint offers in terms of this being on, I assume it's a panel and not just specifically alone.
Yeah, you're correct. Yeah, we do. We offer a specific panel. It's a targeted panel for this condition. And that's kind of generally how we set up our panels. We have some that are targeted, so only include a couple of genes. So that way in, you know, for example, in this case, where there was a functional assay done that essentially gave you a clinical diagnosis, which we've seen in a lot of genetic conditions, right? You have one assay that can do a clinical diagnosis, and then you have the genetic assay that can really confirm which specific gene is involved. And this is a perfect example of that. So with Blueprint, we have a targeted panel for that situation. We also then include these genes on some of our larger panels, kind of our more non-specific or that include, you know, multiple different IEI categories on it. And so that's just how our panels are designed. A lot of other labs may have similar things. But yeah, this kind of speaks to there's a clinical diagnosis based on some laboratory studies, but then you can also do a genetic diagnosis. And where the genetic diagnosis adds is really from especially that inheritance, because we know there are multiple different forms of inheritance associated with CGD. This is the X-linked form that we're talking about today. And so that has different ramifications for a family. And that can be very important, especially as was said, you know, identifying women who carry this genetic variation and may not have been picked up otherwise because their symptoms were variable or kind of flew under the radar of clinicians' suspicion.
I think we're going to start hearing a lot more of that, of cases like Felicia with your mom, of having a grandkid diagnosed, and then we kind of work our way backwards. So it's almost like reverse cascade testing. Like we think about in cancer, like usually we're testing older people so that younger people have that information. But we're seeing the reverse here, which I think is really interesting. But I would expect with the scientific community being better at diagnosing and faster at diagnosing, that hopefully, you know, that's the trend that we're seeing, that more people in the family will be benefiting from this information and hopefully having better health outcomes, like your mom, Felicia. And you know, I'm thinking just with many disorders, earlier diagnosis ends up making much better health outcomes, like for patients' treatment and sometimes prevention. And, you know, would you say, Felicia, that's been the same for your son? It sounds like he was diagnosed relatively early, I would think, compared to other people, especially because you were very much on it and a very fierce advocate in that way.
Right. Well, thank you for that. We were fortunate that he was diagnosed. And what I didn't mention about this particular condition, which makes it very a cruel disease, is that it's invisible. You can get tricked into thinking that you're healthy because once the diagnosis is made, and even before there, so there's the carrier that we talked about, a female carrier. But we haven't talked about the patient, you know, the CGD patient and their levels as well. You can have zero working neutrophil or you can have some. And so that's where diagnosis can come later on in life as well for the patients. And so what is so dangerous about CGD is A, it can be very hard to diagnose. B, you can live with it for several years and have these infections and maybe being out of the hospital, but no one catches it until there is a very lethal infection. And then it's really, really dangerous. And so that is why it's so important to have a diagnosis and then you can make your decision. So with CGD, you can either live with it through prophylaxis. Carriers can take prophylaxis depending on their severity, or patients can take prophylaxis whether they have let's just say they can take prophylaxis, okay, and that is a choice they can make whether they would like to do that, or they can also consider a curative option, which would be a stem cell transplant. In our case, because Sebastian had zero working neutrophils. He had the most severe form of CGD. He was doing well for several years. It's estimated that once every 3.5 years, there was going to be a lethal infection. It was almost like right at that exact time, he had his first lethal infection. Again, we couldn't find it, see it. There was no, because the body doesn't respond. He looked fine. Meanwhile, there's a terrible infection raging inside of him. And by the time he was symptomatic, it was so serious, so severe in his lungs. So thankfully, his doctors were able to get it under control at Duke University Hospital. They told us that we really needed to move forward with transplant now. And so they got him to the point where he was healthy enough to then go into transplant. And thankfully, we were able to make it through. So that's why, today he's an 11-year-old, very healthy boy, and he has no more CGD symptoms. And so that's why I'm here advocating and talking today, because I want everyone to be able to have the same happy outcome I had. I know what it's like to be that heartbroken, dumbfounded, flabbergasted, just completely lost mother, and to have someone who can provide some information and education, whether it's about genetic testing or, whether it's about different options, different treatment options. These are all ways that our community can be empowered and make the decisions that are best for them.
Congratulations that the stem cell worked, and it was like overall sounds like a relatively good process. It was probably really hard during it, but that, Sebastian's doing so well today. Like, that is just so fantastic to hear. And that your mission is just very, noble of just, okay, I've been through this and I know so much. Let me pass that on to other people that are in this community. And I think going off of that, I wanted to ask you how important that collaboration piece is between the patients, the caregivers, the advocacy groups, medical experts, and just improving the lives of people living with this condition. Because, we've been talking about your son, but I imagine this really ranges in terms of ages that are affected, especially if people are not the most severe form, as Sebastian is, or I guess was, mm-hmm. because that is a cure. Yes. How important was it for Sebastian's care, but also just what you notice in the community as being so active?
Well, this is a really broader conversation because having rare disease, and there are 30 million patients with rare disease in the United States, I don't think people realize how actually not rare it is to be rare.
Rare alone, not together. It's like 10% of people. Yeah.
Exactly. But because there are so many different ones, it can be extremely isolating for all of us. And it's challenging, of course, to deal with the disease itself. Then it's challenging because I didn't feel like anyone could relate to what I was going through. And the way that I navigated my path forward, other than, of course, my doctors and the medical experts at the NIH, to whom I'll always be grateful, is through other parents who had been through it. And connecting with them was of the utmost importance. I was able to feel that I could do this because I met other parents who had done it, who told me I could do it. I'll never forget one mother who had two sons go through transplant at the same time for CGD. And I just said, I don't think I can do this. I can't even imagine doing it for my one son. I am squeamish when it comes to, because, I wasn't what I considered, a person who liked the sight of blood, or, they're after transplant. Parents are expected to take on the role of nurses. I don't know if many people realize that, but we're expected to do blood draws. We're expected to do infusions. We're expected to give all the medicine. We're expected to even, take care of the central line in many ways, and change the dressing and all of these things, because it's a very long process. People often don't understand how long the bone marrow transplant or stem cell transplant process is. It could be as long as a year from start to finish till the time the person is healed and able to go back into public. So she said to me, Felicia, you can do it and you will do it. And she was right. We don't know what we're capable of until we're in that situation. We don't know how strong we are. We don't know the resources that are within us. But I did it. And everyone else out there who's facing a challenge right now, who's listening to this podcast, can do it as well.
Well, thank you so much. Just on behalf of the genetics community of, you know, being genetic counselors like me and Tori, that we can only do so much. I don't mean to speak for Tori, but we can provide like the textbook information, right? And say, this is what the condition is. But it's a whole different level when someone can talk to someone else that's a little bit further in the journey and say, like, this is what it's like, because you're doing as much research as we are. So, and, you know, many patient advocates may not have a degree specifically in genetics, but at this point, I feel like you should have an honorary one, because you have to learn so much, and you're really forced to be in that position. But that, you know, you seem to take it with such grace and such humility of just being able to pass this on to other people. Like, you know, your son is cured. Like, you could be like, all right, that was a time in our past and I'm moving on. But you are so deeply committed to this. And I really, you know, commend you for just putting this effort in and just taking the time right now to be, you know, speaking to my audience, and just really appreciate that. And just how open you are too with your story. I think that just, it really will resonate with people. But I mean, I've learned so much. I don't necessarily always learn a ton each episode as I get further into my career, but this is definitely one of those episodes where I was like, I know I will learn a lot because I don't know a lot about this. So thank you both so much, Tori and Felicia, for just explaining all of this. And, you know, I think there's a lot more to get into. So, you know, we'll definitely have to keep covering these types of conditions on the show, but certainly rare diseases is close to my heart. We have a lot of episodes about it, but thank you both so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. And if anyone's interested in learning more about the CGD community or joining one of our events, we have Zoom talks, we have webinars, we have virtual events where we get together, we talk to specialists, we talk to other parents, and we don't just talk about CGD, we talk about rare disease, immune deficiencies, we talk about what it's like to be a caregiver. So you'll find a very warm and embracing community there. Our website is www.cgdaa.org, and I welcome everyone to come and check us out.
Definitely. And that link will be in the show notes for everybody, so you can check out those Zoom talks, virtual events, like everything you have going on. But thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com, where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.